Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. This week, we're going to be geeking out on science, and we've been, in fact, geeking out on science in Ask Dr. Dawn under one form or another since 1993. Think of it. Homestretch to that 30th anniversary. It's been a long, long time here on the radio, and I'm pleased to still be here. Today, we have germs in space. We'll discuss exciting new findings on CBD and Alzheimer's disease and learn about the epigenetics of caffeine. But first, two new developments on the COVID front, just briefly. First of all, masking post-vaccination recommendations were posted this week, and common sense has prevailed. And if you have been vaccinated and are 2 weeks past your vaccination, you can be in a room without masks in a closed space with other people who fit that criteria. And you're even allowed to visit one household, one isolated household. And this is true if the people there are younger, even if they are not vaccinated. And that might include, say, your grandchildren. I know that there are many, many people out there who were waiting for this. And it's the end of the beginning or the very, very beginning of the end. Stay tuned for more information on that. The other was a recent paper that went viral on the internet about using a first cousin to Prozac as a treatment for COVID-19. The agent, fluvoxamine, is also trade name Fluvox, an antidepressant. It works by preventing the neuron from taking up the serotonin that is sitting in the synapse and stimulating the next neuron down the line. So this is a way of increasing serotonin levels in the brain, and some individuals, this is very, very helpful for depression. It was back in the day when these drugs were first discovered, it was a game changer because the previous drugs that we gave for depression were actually really good suicide agents if you took an overdose. So you could see the catch-22 there. But this study looked at people living in the community, non-hospitalized adults who had severe acute respiratory, basically they had SARS-CoV infection that was positive by PCR testing, and they had had symptoms onset within the last 7 days, and they had at least a 92% oxygen. So why Fluvox? Why fluvoxamine? The reason is a compound in the endoplasmic reticulum of human cells called SIR. It's the alpha-1 receptor SIR agonism. SIR is a chaperone protein. It does some regulation in terms of protein production, specifically regulating cytokine production through this IREI receptor. That stands for inositol-requiring enzyme 1-alpha. Previous studies had looked at affinities. We've talked recently on the show over the last year a lot about how they scan things for, oh, this drug is used for this, but it also fits in this receptor. Might be useful in the future. Let's keep that in mind. That's how we found the putative drugs ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, through those receptor shape kind of analyses. And of course, some of these things worked out very well. There's the jury still out. Ivermectin has a neutral statement from the FDA, but there is reason to expect that it might interfere with the spike protein hitting the ACE1 receptor. So that's a good thing. When you reduce cytokines, you get a reduced inflammatory response. And there have been studies looking at mouse models of sepsis showing that this would work. Now, since fluvoxamine is such a strong SIR agonist and it gets into the cells quickly because it's fat soluble, the researchers postulated that maybe this could work. So they were located in the St. Louis metropolitan area. Basically, I guess, eastern Missouri and southern Illinois both count as being part of that area. And starting in around April and going through August 5th, they solicited people for this study. And they will get to the issues with the study, but I just want to deliver the results from the placebo. They received about 100 milligrams of this three times daily for 15 days. That's the fluvoxamine. It's a big dose. Or they got placebo. And what they looked at was clinical deterioration within 15 days of randomization, which they either had to have shortness of breath or hospitalization for shortness of breath or pneumonia, and an oxygen saturation that dropped to less than 92%. So they had 152 patients randomized. About 80 were in the fluvoxamine group, and 72 were in the placebo group. There were no clinical deteriorations in the fluvoxamine group, and 6 deteriorations in the placebo group. So that works out to a highly statistically significant number, 8.7%. The fluvoxamine group had 1 adverse event and the placebo group had 6 adverse events. That is to say, their COVID got worse. It was a very, very creative way to do this study because they basically gave the people that signed up, it was all done remotely. So they shipped them a log to record their symptoms. They got a blood pressure monitor. They got a pulse oximeter and they got a pregnancy test. I guess everybody got the pregnancy test, but probably only the women did it. They used a 1-to-10-point scale, but unfortunately, some of the questionnaires, there was a real problem getting the data and there was a real problem with follow through. And that's the first of the issues that I'm going to present. The study did try very hard to randomize people, and they stratified them by age, 18 to 44, 45 to 54, 55 to 64, and greater than 65. So they tried to make sure that they got equal numbers of the sexes and, you know, all the things that they could think of, roughly equal numbers of people with diseases as it worked out. Actually, I think that's another commentary, is that the number of diseases was fairly high in this population of individuals. And I won't go into too many of the weeds. Fluvoxamine dosing was done gradually ramping people up to a high dose of 300 milligrams a day. And as I said, they measured clinical deterioration, and that was the one that they got the statistical significance on. But they had a lot of problems with ascertainment because many participants stopped responding to the surveys. And they had to basically go look at medical records or call hospitals and look at the oxygen companies and, you know, really delve into the details to actually figure out how people did. But clinical deterioration in 6 versus 0 sounds pretty good until we take a look at the table 1, which is the baseline characteristics. I think it's super important to point out that when you look at the treatment group versus the placebo group, even without the drug working at all, there are several concerns one can notice about the differences between the two groups that could lead to more deterioration in the placebo group. For one thing, even though there were more people in the treatment group, there were more Black people in the placebo group. There is also 1 Native American in the placebo group, and we all know that those groups are more likely to suffer more severe COVID. So that's a pretty important confound, as we say. The other big issue, as when I look through this, is I realize there's a gaping hole in their randomization because they do not appear to have randomized or excluded for smoking status. So if you just accidentally got, say, 10 more smokers in the placebo group, that could account for that plus the racial differences could easily account for this so-called treatment effect. So I think we have to step back and say, we don't have time really to gain as much information as we like. We don't have years That's why we're doing all these vaccinations under an emergency use act rather than doing it under FDA approval, because we don't have time for the data. We have a crisis on our hands. So it's a pretty cheap drug that, while it has to be taken in higher doses than were typically used when this was being used as an antidepressant, they did show a possible benefit. As I said, the randomization was a little flawed, but it does seem like it might be useful, and the downside risks are fairly low, and it's available as a generic. So I'm hoping, since this was just published and they finished in August, that the group is going to come up with a better, or someone else will come up with a better, bigger study, and hopefully that will give us more information and maybe even something that we can feel confident using, and that would be awesome. Well, you've probably noticed, if you spend any time at all looking at videos from the space station, that hair behaves very differently in space. Everyone can have an afro if they like, unless they've got very, very short hair, including women with straight blonde beach hair like mine. So this is a really fun story. This is a study looking at whether microbes can become more infectious in spaceflight. And it turns out microgravity and weightlessness can increase the effectivity of cells. In this case, the researchers were looking at the human intestinal bacteria Salmonella typhimurium. Salmonella, food poisoning, I'm sure you've heard of it. It's a problem with undercooked chicken, for example. And it's also, you can get that by handling your reptiles and then eating a snack without washing your hands. But can you imagine a Salmonella epidemic in space, having, you know, severe diarrhea in space? That would be awful. And because it's fairly contagious, if any of it didn't exit the room, so to speak, because of the fact that those toileting facilities are, you know, dealing with weightlessness, we could end up with an entire crew coming down with serious disease. So it's important that we think about this. This group has been studying microgravity for a while, and they have already reported that the bacteria changes in space, the Salmonella typhimurium, and when you get it back to Earth and try to infect cell cultures, it's more efficient at infecting. But this was the first time they ever tried to do it up on the space station. So this research really did uncover that there are alterations in the RNA and protein expression in human cells and the RNA expression in bacterial cells. And they were simultaneously running ground-based samples with the same technique at the same time for the same duration. So the things that were different, of course, are the return to gravity on reentry. But when they looked at those changes, essentially, they were fairly substantial and didn't change that much in the Salmonella after it hit the ground. It really does look like it's a durable effect. You know, Salmonella's been around for as long as there's been probably humanity, and it causes 1.3 million infections in the United States and 26,000 hospitalizations every year, also 420 deaths. So this is non-trivial. It is a poop-to-mouth disease. It can also be transmitted through the ingestion of contaminated food and water, and it attaches to intestinal cells. Pretty sophisticated bugs, you know, they've been around this long. They've got some fairly serious defenses. So they used a new technology called dual RNA sequencing, which allows them to do sequencing under microgravity. How are the cells changing? What different proteins are they making? What different suppressing RNAs are they making? Basically, they found that there were global changes across the transcriptional and proteomic expression, heightened virulence, and improved resistance to stress. It's like they sent the bacteria to boot camp and they got stronger. Pretty cool technology, I just have to say. They built these little tissue culture systems called hollow fiber bioreactors, little thin, porous-like straw fibers coated with collagen, and they dumped the intestinal cells in there and gave them 11 days to grow. And this is all happening in space. And then they had hardware system, which pumped warm cell culture fluid through the fibers, kept the cells healthy. After 11 days of being allowed to grow and coat the fibers, the salmonella was injected, just was what was happening on Earth at the same time. And they compared the uninfected epithelial cells in space to those on Earth. They found major proteins for cell structure. Yeah, they weren't building the same cells, were they? They weren't being stimulated by gravity. They also had a different level of epithelial barrier. They were less able to function like intestinal cells. That would lead to more leaky gut and poorer wound healing, even potentially a higher risk of cancer. Plus, don't forget, radiation when you're up there on the space station. So these are important findings as well. And in the bacteria, they were able to find, as we said, an improvement in its infectiousness and its resistance to stress. So the researchers who wrote this article end by saying, you know, we probably need to give nutritional supplements and probiotic microbes to the astronauts. And I want to point out one of the things that they do for the astronauts is they feed them a fairly low fiber diet, because obviously they really don't want them to make too much poop. But the problem with that is that that low fiber diet endangers the naturally protective microbiome. So maybe the solution to this is improve the diet of the astronauts, give them some probiotics, and figure out the toilet issue so that no salmonella escapes into the atmosphere. However, things are going to be different in space. I suppose that's no surprise, but it's really, really interesting. We're going to move now to a really interesting deep dive, at least I hope you'll find it interesting, on the genetics, or rather the epigenetics of caffeine. We all have slightly different genetic variations, and some of those, as regular listeners will know, are related to your ability to detoxify certain substances or render them harmless or activate them, for that matter. Other changes are on the shape of the receptors. So individuals who have a different variant, going back to COVID for a moment, on the ACE2 receptor have different levels of vulnerability to this virus and to other viral targets as well. So you can be a magnet or you can be kind of wearing a raincoat when it comes to viral infection. But we're talking about coffee, which is statistically the most widely used beverage in the world after water. And we know there are effects on liver health, appetite, gastric emptying, cognitive decline, and cardiometabolic diseases. And the effects are not uniform and not fully agreed upon, and studies in different countries disagree with each other. And that's probably because of the genetics. Also, for that matter, the genetics of the coffee and how it was prepared. I remember a study from some years ago, gosh, must be 15 or 20 years ago, actually, that demonstrated quite clearly that if you put your coffee through a paper filter, the paper filter absorbs some terpenes, which have a tendency in susceptible individuals to raise cholesterol. So coffee has hundreds of chemical substances, but caffeine is there in a large amount. So we're going to look at caffeine, how it works, and what the genetics show us. First of all, the main thing that caffeine does is to antagonize, that is to say, interfere with receptors for adenosine, which is a neurotransmitter and arguably a vascular hormone in that it has profound effects on the heart and the blood vessels. It also inhibits a class of enzymes called phosphodiesterases. This leads to the accumulation of something called cyclic AMP, which is another neurotransmitter. And the effect of more cyclic AMP is an intensification of the ability of adrenaline, your circulating adrenaline, to stimulate the adrenaline receptor. This is responsible for the psychoactivation and also for the pretty complex cardiovascular response, which we'll be addressing over the next few minutes. So you have to get in trouble with caffeine. You have to get above 400 milligrams a day, which might, depending on whose coffee you're drinking, that could be 5 single espressos. I tend to drink my coffee in a large mug. I'm probably grazing 300 milligrams a day in my 2 large 16-ounce mugs, or I would be, rather, if I wasn't doing a half caffeine dose. But there's a lot of variability, and some of it's tolerance, because if you drink a lot of caffeine, your body will upregulate an enzyme that breaks caffeine down called cytochrome P450-1A2. And it breaks down a lot of the caffeine, but there's a lot of intra-individual variety. If you get just a single substitute letter, a nucleotide, an A instead of a C, you'll decrease the ability of caffeine to stimulate more of the 1A2 enzyme being made. Therefore, you'll be fairly unable to tolerate it. This is very similar to the mutation that causes people in certain ethnic groups not to be able to tolerate the effects of alcohol, and they don't upregulate their alcohol breakdown products and therefore have an increased risk of alcoholism. We talked about how the caffeine antagonizes adenosine, and it does that by affecting one particular adenosine receptor called A2A. Now, if you have a genetic variation there, you'll get much more anxiety and sleep disturbance. And we mentioned that accumulations of cyclic AMP. Well, if you have a mutation in an enzyme called AMP deaminase, you will increase adenosine availability for the receptors, and that might mitigate some of the negative effects of those other mutations. There's also a great deal of genetic polymorphism on the adrenaline receptors themselves. Depending on which polymorphism of the alpha-2, alpha-1, and the beta-1, 2, and 3 adrenergic receptors, which are basically on all cells of your body just about, you're going to get a variation in how you respond to this. And one more, a very common mutation that I see quite a lot in people, a problem with catechol-O-L methyltransferase, which breaks down neurotransmitters. So in people with a weak catechol-O-L methyltransferase, they tend to have essentially more bang from the buck for whatever amount of adrenaline they release, thus causing them to have more anxiety, more tachycardia. And here's something really important for women who are in the menopause age. Adrenergic receptors shift with menopause. So as those estrogen levels drop and the trophic hormones from the pituitary rise, you get a change in the adrenergic receptors, making them more likely to react to lower amounts of caffeine. I like to say that hot flashes should be thought of as a smoke alarm. Once you get past the year or two out of menopause, hot flashes mean that you are getting a lot of adrenaline there, especially nocturnal hot flashes. And so I've recently begun suggesting that women who have this problem into their 60s try very, very small doses, very subtherapeutic doses of a class of antihypertensive drugs called beta blockers. These are used for hypertension, as I indicated, but blocking the beta receptors, particularly the beta 1 receptors, seems to help quite a lot with the flushing and the heat. This can't, of course, be done in people who are taking drugs that might interfere with that. And in people with low blood pressure, people with osteoporosis, you'd have to be very careful on risk benefit, because if they drop their blood pressure when they get up in the middle of the night to pee, they could fall and hurt themselves. So even with identical twins, there's quite a lot of variation in caffeine-related traits. That's because of epigenetics. Just where you are in the womb can influence whether you have an upregulated or a downregulated caffeine sensing mechanism. And therefore, depending on what other variations are along for the ride, it can make a big difference. Now, when you give an overdose of caffeine, you will get hypertension. But in a study of moderate coffee drinkers, there are some specific genes which are all on the receptors that we talked about for the cyclic AMP. And when you have these, you will get a much bigger change in your peak systolic blood pressure with caffeine. In this study, one double espresso would, in groups who have this mutation, could yield a significant or a sufficient amount of caffeine to create a systolic blood pressure rise, whereas in people without that variant, you would not see it. I think you're getting the sense that getting your genes looked at and seeing whether you have these variants is starting to look like a really good idea. And right now, I'm in the process of learning more about the various platforms that will do this type of testing. I think it's going to be a really important addition to my functional medicine practice, because when you can personalize your choice of agents and the advice becomes individualized and specific to the person rather than one size fits all, we can start to be much more effective in our preventative work. So the main thing to understand is that your response to caffeine has been the topic of this. If you are a slow metabolizer, you need to keep your caffeine down to under 2 cups a day because your risk of heart attack goes up and your blood pressure goes up if you don't. Figuring that out about yourself, especially if there's a strong family history of cardiovascular disease, would probably be a good idea. Sometime I'll do a longer lesson on how you can do some of these things. But ultimately, as I said, I'm still researching which platforms represent the best state of the art. And when I have a conclusion, you'll be the second to know. So we've talked about caffeine, and many of you probably know that caffeine has also been implicated in preterm labor and also in miscarriage and maybe even infertility, although that one's harder to prove. Anyway, some of that probably has to do with the interaction between the caffeine and the catecholaminergic system that we just finished talking about, and how that is related to our following topic, which is how maternal stress triggers idiopathic preterm birth. Before we even launch into this, I want to comment on something that I think is definitely related here. African American women have a 50% risk of preterm labor in pregnancy, 50% increase. That's substantial. Even college-educated and higher-income Black women still have more preterm babies than high school-educated white women who are presumably in poorer economic circumstances. We know that there is a kind of wear and tear that happens to African Americans in this society. I will point out that this is not a racial effect. You do not see it in Africa. You do not see it in other countries. You see it in this one. We've got a lot to fix in our society. I'm sure you're aware of that. The last year has not been pretty, and I think it's clear that there are double standards and economic disadvantages, as well as what are sometimes called microaggressions. And even if those are unintended on the part of the person who gives them, they are received on the part of the person who receives them. And that creates a vicious cycle, I think, of walking around braced. I see a lot of people in my practice who are survivors of abusive childhoods. And sometimes the abuse is just a father who yells and screams at them all the time. It doesn't have to be physical, but it causes them to be walking on eggshells. And if you spend your life walking on eggshells, you have higher cortisol levels. And now we have a really solid, not just an association, but an actual mechanism. Here it is. Cortisol, the fight or flight hormone, acts through a binding protein called FKPB51, and it binds to progesterone receptors, where it inhibits progesterone receptor function in the uterus. And progesterone is what's responsible for keeping the uterus from starting to contract as it's stretched by the growing baby. So the reduced progesterone receptor stimulation actually ends up stimulating labor. You're literally, stress is taking your foot off of the brake. It's important to have really high levels of progesterone throughout the pregnancy. And anything that reduces the receptor expression, whether it's low progesterone output or other factors, is going to be a problem here, including nutrition. In the brain, this elevated FKBP51 expression has been strongly associated with an increased risk for stress-related mental disorders. So maybe this is something that means that it amplifies the effect of your stress hormones. The more of that you've got in your brain, the more likely that event X is going to stress you out. And we all know people who get stressed very easily compared to other people who don't. Now, researchers have also shown that when you get to 37 to 42 weeks of pregnancy, which is when normal human labor starts, what you see in the uterus is reduced numbers of progesterone receptors and increased expression of FKBP51. In other words, calling all cortisol, let's reduce it further. We're going to reduce the amount of action progesterone could have so that we can get this baby born. Now, naturally, in this study, they used knockout mice, this study I'm about to talk about, and so they made human decidual cells, which are the cells that line the uterus. These were not mutated, and then they had a mouse model in which the FKBP5 was, which is the gene for making FKBP51, had been removed. And what they found was that if you don't have this enzyme, FKBP51, the mice were very resistant to maternal stress. They could handle way more stress without preterm birth than normal mice, but also they actually had a hard time giving birth. They tended to have post-date litters because the normal mechanism for initiating labor was interfered with. So what we can see is that the levels of this compound were greater and the binding was greater to progesterone receptors in the decidual cells of women who had had idiopathic preterm birth, and compared to the cells of gestationally age-matched controls. So these changes were physically present at the time of the pregnancy, and this is a marker for preterm birth risk. If a baby is born before 34 weeks, they have a lifetime of increased risk for long-term health complications. If they get through childhood without lung or heart disease or neurodevelopmental delays, they have an increased risk of diabetes, an increased risk of obesity, and these things are persistent for the rest of their lifetime due to genetic imprinting and things that should occur late in gestation, which simply aren't allowed to occur. We've got a lot of work to do here, but at least this shows us a path. We may be able to develop drugs that inhibit the FKBP51 from doing this in people who do have high stress levels, and I can definitely see it being given as a preventative sometime down the line for women who are pregnant in high stress situations, regardless of race. But it may become standard of care for African Americans. And until we have the drug that somebody can sell to you, what we do have is we need to, as a society, be especially careful and kind to our pregnant women. It does matter. We need to open doors for them, carry their groceries, tell them that we care about them, that we care about the baby that they're trying to bring healthy into the world. We need to consider more generous policies of prenatal either disability or leave, something that would allow women for the last couple of months of their pregnancy to not be stressed out, not be going to work, not be telecommuting either. Give them a chance to chill and have a peaceful pregnancy. And I think we would make a lot of the money back on the hind end of that because of the beneficial effect it would have on medical costs and in the long run on the reduction of disability. And a disabled child is going to live for a long time and is going to need support. So if we actually close the loop on cost, it might be even a break even. And even if it wasn't, what the heck? You know, we're talking about human life and human suffering. And isn't that the purpose of being in a collective society, to try to help each other out and away from potential for suffering? I certainly think so. Looks like we have Tim in Santa Cruz. Let's look at Tim's question. Charlie was able to tell me that those were about fecal implants. So fecal implants, which have, I think, great promise as long as you can get good quality poop. It's a little bit like reverse nutrition. You need good quality food to build a healthy body, and you need good quality poop to maintain it. Right now in the United States, there is only one laboratory who is licensed to provide poop for fecal implants, and I believe that's in Massachusetts. All of the fecal transplants that you hear about are done using their poo. And I've often wondered about the people who supply that and what requirements they have, presumably a healthy diet, high in fiber, and don't eat junk food. But I wonder, you know, what's the ascertainment to make sure that they're doing that? Getting back to fecal implants, even one delivery of a slurry of poop, this is either given through an NG tube, or it's given through a rectal tube, delivered as close to the colon as you can get it, has miraculous benefits in the Clostridium difficile infections that are persistent. It has clear benefit in research done on colitis, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease, and has, in fact, got approval, although it's being very tightly controlled right now and is mostly in clinical trials, for treatment of those conditions. Not just any poop will do, however. And so this is definitely at the children don't try this at home stage, because obviously you can, if there's a sickness in the individual, you're just literally mainlining that sickness into yourself. So it's probably not going to become widely available until we get to the point where we can actually grow in large vats cultures of healthy poo. And because of many of these bacteria are killed off by oxygen, they want to grow in a soil-type environment where there's very little oxygen, a so-called anaerobic environment, then it'll be a while, I think, before we get the technology where it needs to be. But I am certain that there's money being thrown at this problem, because it's a huge product opportunity if it can ever be developed, despite the sort of, you know, gross quality of it. We've been able to persuade people of the benefits of colonoscopies, for example, and pap smears, for that matter. And so that is, you know, really substantial. Okay, who am I talking to? Who's talking right now? Tom, hello.
One of the goods and the bads about white mushrooms that we get in stores, and about soy.
All right. Well, let's start with the goods on mushrooms. Mushrooms are, even the white ones that you get in the stores, they're pretty organic. They don't get a lot of pesticides or other compounds. So they're effectively the ultimate organic, because they're saprophytes. They're living off dead and dying plant material. Mushrooms have very interesting chemicals, in fact, dozens of them, that are very stimulatory to the immune system. They're stimulating in the way of helping the body fight the T cells in particular. And so they're used a lot in Asia, particularly Japan and China, for extracts of mushrooms are used as part of cancer therapy. And there's good data, not as much of it in the United States literature as I would like. Mushrooms also contain some compounds like beta-glycan, which are immune modulators, direct immune modulators, and help reduce inflammation. So you have the brown mushrooms, you have the large brown mushrooms that we call portobellos, you have the shiitake, you have the mayake. You've got so many different mushrooms, and they all have other compounds that are present in high levels that are unique, or at least the concentration of them varies across the mushrooms. And it appears that the best strategy, if you're eating mushrooms for health, is to eat a wide variety of them so that you get a little bit of all the good compounds. And I, when I use functional medicine to help support people who are fighting cancer, and I want to emphasize, I do not think that functional medicine or mushrooms can replace actual oncological state-of-the-art medical therapy. It's not my thought, but I have confidence that it can be a value added and it can help. So that's the take on mushrooms. Well, I believe that Tom wanted to know about soy. Soy is a much more complicated topic, which is why I kind of stopped. Soy is really dependent on whether it is GMO or not. And not because the GMO made the soy toxic, but because the GMO made the soy be Roundup resistant. And Roundup is just not something you want to be eating. The data is quite clear. It does not break down in the soil. It does contribute to leaky gut. And leaky gut is the root of all evil when you're a functional medicine doctor. So that being said, soy has some interesting properties in that there are compounds in soy that mimic, will fit into the estrogen receptors. We talk a lot about receptors nowadays. Estrogen is a very strong magnet for its own receptors. As you might expect, they're custom designed for estrogen. But the soy compounds will also fit into those receptors. They just aren't as strong a magnet. So think about a weak magnet versus a strong magnet. It takes a lot more to pull off the strong magnet off your refrigerator than the weak magnet. Well, now what's our context? If I'm a woman who's having really hard periods, lots of breast tenderness, soy will probably be really good for me because it's going to be occupying those estrogen receptors at least part of the time. And that effectively reduces the amount of estrogen stimulation that happens because these are only a weak stimulator, the soy products, whereas estrogen is a very strong stimulator. If I'm a woman who is taking a drug to lower estrogen in my body because I have a breast cancer with estrogen receptors, I don't want any estrogen stimulation at all. So any soy is probably not a great idea because it does have a mild stimulant effect. We know that during puberty, when girls have very, very high estrogen levels, at least girls of Japanese and Chinese descent, I don't know if this has been checked in Caucasians, but if a girl is eating soy during that transition into puberty from, say, the age of 11 to 14, she has a lower lifetime risk of breast cancer. It's a very complicated issue. So you can't say that soy is either, well, you could say that GMO soy is bad. That is easy. But when it comes to should a person be using soy for one of their major protein sources, that really, really depends on both their own biological situation and whether or not and what kind of form of soy they're eating. For example, edamame, which is raw soybeans, contains compounds that will interfere with thyroid functioning. This is reduced somewhat when you make tofu out of it and eliminated completely when you make fermented soy products such as tempeh. So as you can see, it's not really soy. It's what you make of it and who you are before you can say, what's the lowdown on soy? Thank you for the call. And I'm sorry we weren't able to get the other thing. It was probably just a bad connection on his end. So coming back to CBD, which I know everybody loves to talk about, and I'm loving to talk about this because it improved two proteins that are important to reducing beta amyloid plaque. In an experimental model of early onset familial Alzheimer's, it actually worked pretty well. The proteins are called TREM2 and interleukin-33, and they are important for the brain's immune cells to literally chew up dead cells, clean out the debris like beta amyloid, and clean up the broom. Without it, your brain becomes kind of a hoarder. These investigators report that CBD normalizes the level in compounds of these proteins And it also reduced IL-6, which is an inflammatory protein which is associated with brain inflammation. Normally, you only find interleukin-33 in the brain, where it helps sound an alarm that there is an invader, like, oh, beta amyloid accumulation, and calls the janitor service. It's also a regulatory protein, probably affecting the immune response and how the immune response in the brain responds to the environment. So in Alzheimer's, increasing IL-33 turns down inflammation and restores balance. It also triggered receptor expressed on some myeloid cells that are found on the cell surface, and it basically stimulates the microglia, which are a special population of cells in the brain that are key to eliminating invaders like viruses and also to getting rid of damaged neurons. Now, we know that low levels of TREM2, this receptor, are associated with Alzheimer's, and in the mouse model that these folks used, these were both quite low. Both of them are involved in essentially cleaning up phagocytosis and chewing up beta amyloid. So when they gave CBD to these mice, and they gave it, by the way, by injecting it into the abdomen of the mice every other day for 2 weeks, they got sevenfold and tenfold increases in these two important regulatory protein. We also know that CBD has a benefit for adult respiratory distress syndrome, an inflammatory disorder, and it may be helpful during the cytokine storm of ARDS. It has not yet, ARDS, that is to say, the adult respiratory distress syndrome, it has not been tested in COVID, but that's an interesting thing to think about. Now, when they looked at people with familial Alzheimer's, this is the early Alzheimer's, symptoms typically happen in the 30s and 40s, it's about 10% of cases, and they found CBD was effective in improving the functioning of individuals who have this type of Alzheimer's. It will probably work, although it hasn't been tested, in the non-familial Alzheimer's, the one that happens in, usually starts in your 60s with symptoms or later. But this beta amyloid starts out in the brain 15 or 20 years before dementia. And so if we can prevent the accumulation of it, this could be a real big game changer. The FDA is about to make a ruling on whether or not a new experimental drug, a monoclonal, which helps attack and clear beta amyloid, will get approval. We're waiting on the final data there. But CBD is available already. Now, I haven't got any sense for the dose here. So I do not know if you're going to take this and run with it. I do not know how much to tell you to take. But I am finding this extremely reassuring, because we're headed for an iceberg of Alzheimer's if we don't figure something out. A whole lot of people in the boomer generation are going to really bring down the system. They live a long time, and if the number that gets Alzheimer's is anything like the number that's getting it today, we're in trouble. It's time, on that not-so-pleasant note, well, maybe it's pleasant as well, it's double-edged, to say goodnight, and I hope you'll join me next week with your phone calls and your emails. You can email me right now at AskDrDawn.com. Go to the website and click on the Contact Us. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.